Welcome to the Conversations Politics Podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Today we're talking with former Prime Minister John Howard in his new capacity as historian. He's just written a history of the Menzies government that was elected in 1949 and ran through to 1966, except he's taken the story right on to the change of government to Gough Whitlam. As journalist Paul Kelly said in launching the book today, Australia's second longest serving Prime Minister has written the story of the longest serving one. John Howard, this has been a very big exercise. What decided you to take it on?
A number of reasons, Michelle. I believe that the political history of Australia is a lot richer and more interesting than many Australians have allowed for. But as well, it was a period of remarkable stability, that 23-year period from 1949 to 1972. And in so many ways, the architecture of modern Australia was put in place during the Menzies era. And it also happened to be the period that started with my first recollection seriously of politics when I was age 10 in 1949. And all of the events that I've covered in the book, I remember in some way from my early years and later, of course, into young adulthood.
What was your memory of that election night in 1949?
Oh, very vivid. I'd gone to the pictures, the movies were then called, with one of my older brothers and my parents. While we were watching the second film, a slide appeared on the screen saying, LCP takes early lead. And when we got home, my eldest brother was sitting in front of the big radio in our dining room and said, Menzies is in, and the biggest swing has been in Queensland.
And many years later, you got a big swing
in Queensland. I got a very big swing in Queensland. Those Queenslanders were most of the time very good voters. They got one year slightly wrong, but we won't go into that.
And your family was obviously quite political.
My parents were both very strong Menzies people. My father probably more so than my mother, because when in 1951 Menzies had a referendum to ban the Communist Party, my mother voted no, my father voted yes. To my knowledge, and I think I'm right in this, it was the only occasion on which my parents voted differently.
Did they have some vigorous debates?
They had a fairly sharp exchange on that particular issue. My mother thought that Menzies wanted too much power. I remember her saying he'd be a bit of a dictator if he got the chance. I'm not voting yes for this. You can, Lyle, if you want to, but I'm not.
Now, writing history is always a journey of discovery. Can you share a couple of the interesting discoveries you made, whether about people or about events?
Well, quite a number of, more about people. One of the people I found quite fascinating that I discovered was on the Labor side, Ted Theodore, who was the Labor Party treasurer in the Scullin government in the early 1930s, and he actually proposed, way ahead of its final implementation, to establish a reserve bank. But he was blocked in his attempts in the Senate, would you believe, by the then Country Party and Nationalist Party. And he was an interesting man, Theodore. He had a fairly interesting career, a checkered career, with some of his business dealings, but he later formed an alliance with Frank Packer and they set up the Women's Weekly, and he had a very active business career, but I found him a fascinating character.
Now, you argue that Menzies was the architect of modern Australia in regard both to the economy and to foreign policy. What evidence do you see for this?
Well, in foreign policy, it was under his government that the ANZUS Treaty was laid, and he's the bedrock of that's the bedrock of our security arrangements. We joined the CETO alliance. We played a major role in resisting Indonesia's confrontation of Malaysia. We, of course, followed and supported the Americans in Vietnam. Very importantly, though, on the trade front, it was during the Menzies government that the 1957 Commerce Agreement with Japan was signed. And that was the first real gateway, trading gateway, into Asia. On economic policy, the most crucial thing was the defeat of the attempt by Chifley in the late 1940s to nationalise the banks. If that had succeeded, then the whole character of the Australian economy in the 1950s and 60s would have been totally different. And it was during the Menzies period that a great middle class emerged in Australia, and levels of home ownership grew quite dramatically. And the aspirational middle class, which is a fundamental element of Australian society to this day, really emerged during that time.
Now, of course, he was helped somewhat, though, wasn't he? Because this was the post-war period, and therefore you would have expected greater growth as the economy returned to some normality. So the time suited him, if I may borrow a phrase of your own.
Well, they did to some degree, that's correct. However, there are plenty of examples in history of people who might have propitious times, but they don't handle them well, or they make them less propitious than they might otherwise be. And it's not as if there weren't some economic challenges during Menzies' time. For example, there was an extremely big burst of inflation at the time of the Korean War wool boom, and inflation 1 year shot up to 23%. Now, the government handled that crisis effectively, and within a year it had gone back to normal. So certainly there were some good economic conditions, but the government's capacity to handle those conditions when there were some adverse events is one of the reasons why it remained in office for so long.
Should he have been more forward-looking on issues like opening up the economy, for example, or was it simply that that situation hadn't yet arisen?
Well, as a famous man once said, context is everything. And the context of the times was that the economy was growing strongly, unemployment was less than 2%, home ownership was rising steeply, we were taking in large numbers of migrants, and the economy was working very well. In those circumstances, it's not to be criticised in a way that he naturally, and so did everybody else, think that the economic policies being used at that time were the right ones. There certainly was no argument being put from the other side of politics that we should have a different approach. There was, towards the end of the whole Menzies period, an argument beginning about the high levels of tariff protection, but that was right at the end.
What about removing discrimination from immigration? It was the days of White Australia. Should he have been more forward-looking there?
Well, certainly the big change there came after he left, and there's evidence that he was more reluctant to change that approach than was his successor, Harold Holt. He did hold the view that the immigration policy up until then had worked well, and that it was understood and accepted in many parts of Asia. I'm not sure that was right. I don't think it was. But you have to remember once again that the opposition Labor Party was not urging any change, and it was a bipartisan position up until the middle to late 1960s that a White Australia policy should be maintained. But then it changed under Holt, and when Whitlam became Prime Minister, he consolidated the change by himself issuing instructions that race was not to be a criterion and introduced legislation and the like. So in a de facto sense, it was dismantled by the Holt government. In a de jure sense, if I can put it that way, that was confirmed by the Whitlam government.
So were Menzies' attitudes on race prejudice attitudes?
No, I don't think they were prejudice attitudes. I think they were just the attitudes of the time. In those days, people didn't think it was prejudiced. We had an immigration policy that favoured Europeans, and that was seen as supporting a more cohesive society. We look back on it now and we think it was prejudiced, but I don't think people in those days regard themselves as prejudiced, and you really have to accept that it's the context of the time that matters. And, of course, discriminatory immigration policies were practiced in many countries at that time and still are.
How much was the success of Menzies dependent on the weakness of Labor?
Oh, quite a bit of it. But that is always the case. governments that are in office for a long period of time are in part there for a long period of time because their opposition is weak. And the crucial thing is he was able to take advantage of the weakness of the Labor Party. He understood how equivocal they were on national security issues. He was ahead of the game on something such as state aid for Catholic schools. That had been something that had rankled with a group of people in the Australian community who had been long-time traditional supporters of the Labor Party, but it was Menzies who cut through on that issue, seized the advantage and removed 100 years of discrimination against 20 to 25% of the Australian population.
Now, after more than a decade in power, he very nearly lost the 1961 election. How different do you think the assessment of him would be historically if that had happened?
Oh, I think it would have been different. In 1961, he survived with a margin of only two, one after the election of a Speaker, and he was saved by the faithful flow of Democratic Labor Party preferences to the Liberal Party in Victorian seats. If he had lost in 61, he would have been less benignly assessed by history, and people would have said that he lost because the economic policies he had implemented in 1960 and 61 were the wrong ones. And he survived, but the crucial thing is, having survived, he gathered his wits about him and came back with a vengeance in 1963. And his remarkable recovery from a near fatal result in 1961 is one of the great features of his career.
When you look at the at that career as a whole, or at least the part that you're focusing on, what do you think were the faults and the limitations of Menzies as a Prime Minister?
Well, occasionally he probably took his eye off the economic ball. He certainly did in 60-61. Perhaps he placed too great an emphasis in some of his foreign policy attitudes on the utility of the old Commonwealth. I only say perhaps. When it came to fundamental decisions on national security, he was very strongly attuned to the attitudes of the United States and the importance of maintaining a strong alliance with the United States. It's only a relatively small point, but I think probably after the appointment of Sir William Slim as the Governor-General in the early 50s, he might have discarded the practice of recommending British citizens as Governor-General. I think Slim was very acceptable because he was a much revered wartime commander and many Australians had fought under his command and respected him. I think that probably should have been the end of it.
Now, national security issues, as you mentioned, were big in Menzies' time, they were big during your government's time, and again, they're big now. Do you think these issues naturally favour the conservative side of politics in political terms?
They often do. I'm not sure that a sensible Labor government can't do well on national security issues, but there is a tendency, perhaps more so in the past than now, to think that they naturally favour our side of politics. I don't know that I'd put it any more strongly than that.
You've often spoken about the Liberal Party as a broad church. In that broad church, where would you place Menzies on the spectrum?
Well, Menzies, of course, would not have understood some of this language. He was contemptuous of the notion of small L liberalism. He famously wrote about that in a letter to his daughter. Terms such as wet and dry and moderate and far right and the like, they weren't around in his time. Menzies was conservative when it came to the institutions of our society. He showed his liberal instincts with things such as a lot of extra funding for universities, the breakthrough on state aid, those sorts of issues. I would say that on both economic and social issues, he was rather conservative, but I don't use that in the sense so much that it's used now, rather I use it in its classical sense. If you favoured economic change and reform, he wasn't strongly in favour of that because the economic order of the time appeared to work. I suppose in a nutshell, Michelle, I don't think the terms that we now employ to define people in that way necessarily had the same meaning back in Menzies' time.
The political and the media environment have changed dramatically since those days, not just the terminology. How do you think he would have fared today? Frankly, I can't see him in a fluoro jacket.
No, but then maybe you wouldn't have seen some of his successes in a fluoro jacket. I think Menzies would have adapted far more readily than many people imagine. He often gave the impression that he didn't like television, yet I thought he was terrific on television. His commanding presence enabled him to fill the screen both physically and metaphorically. But I can't answer for social media. I didn't have to contend with that myself, and I've only been out of this place for 6.5 years.
He seemed rather an aloof character. Do you think he would have adapted to the more interactive situation of modern politics? He was interactive, of course, at hall meetings.
He was very interactive in a crowd.
Mm.
My theory would be that, excuse me, if you are interactive in the physical presence of a lot of people, you're probably capable of being very interactive in the media.
Menzies operated basically in a monoculture, if you leave aside the Irish, perhaps. We're in a very different society in Australia these days. Just coming to the present, do you think that not enough is being done in modern Australia to integrate, in particular, the Muslim community?
Well, Michelle, let me gently challenge the proposition that he operated in a monocultural society. It was during Menzies' period that millions of people came to this country from a non-English-speaking background. Greeks, Italians, Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians, Czechs, a lot of people from Eastern Europe. So the character of the place had begun to change quite a lot. My view is that we did best when we integrated people. We did best when we welcomed people from all around the world, but from the very beginning encouraged them to become part of the mainstream of the Australian community. As you well know, I've always had doubts about the multicultural mantra. I'm a believer in multiracialism, but I think fundamentally the guiding principle should be everybody is welcome, but once they are here, they become part of Australia.
And are we falling down here, particularly with the Muslim community?
Well, I think there's a particular problem at the moment, but it's not that we're falling down. I don't think you can blame Australia for some of the concerns people have about terrorism. It hasn't originated in Australia. It's not the fault of the Australian community. And the important thing that I note at the moment is the growing numbers of people who are prominent in Islamic communities in Australia who are speaking out strongly against the barbarism being practiced overseas and the ludicrous, indefensible calls that are being made for people to commit random acts of murder and violence. And the more that that happens, the happier I will be.
You mentioned today at your book launch the greater volatility of modern voters, and you make the point in the book, and you were suggesting that while Labor has been in the doldrums at the moment, things could change quite quickly. This did sound like something of a warning to your own side. Do you think that the present federal government will need to make some adjustments to be more flexible?
Oh, I wasn't giving any advice. I was making a self-evident, making an observation about a self-evident truth, and that is that the political climate can change very quickly. The volatility of which I speak means that you can't rely on old approaches. You can't assume a given level of support from a section of the community. Now, that presents a lot of challenges, but it also means that you can't afford not to be relevant with your policy attitudes, and I think it's self-evident that the Labor Party sank to a very low level in 2013, but only 6 years earlier we were out of office everywhere. And people were saying, oh, it's the end of the Liberal Party. Well, it wasn't the end of the Liberal Party. And anybody on our side who's now suggesting that the Labor Party is going to be out for a generation are kidding themselves. That won't be the case. And there are shorter tolerance spans in the electorate now than what there used to be. And people voted for a change of government, but they will assess the present government according to its performance at the next election, and nothing can be taken for granted. Although, let me add that I think the present government has done a very good job. Things like border protection, getting rid of those taxes, the fundamental shape of the budget, they're all in the right direction. And I think the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister especially have handled the security challenges with great aplomb.
Of course, the less tolerance by the electorate in the shorter time frame does mean it's very hard to get up reform measures which do require a bit of patience by the electorate.
Yes, but the electorate is smart enough to know what you're doing. Let me point to New Zealand. You just had New Zealand, the key government has been returned for a third term with an increased majority. It's had a very reformist agenda, and the electorate has rewarded that. And some of the things that it's been rewarded for are yet to come into being. The electorate is smart. I think the modern Australian electorate is a lot more sophisticated than some people give it credit for. And if a proper explanation is made for a policy change and it's seen as fair, then the public will go for it, even though there may be some period of time to elapse before it's finally put in place.
They're talking about changing the flag over there. You wouldn't go down that
route. No, I wouldn't go down. No, I certainly wouldn't touch that, no. But I think part of the problem with the New Zealanders is that they find that their flag is confused for ours, and because we're the bigger country, they feel a bit crowded out. But we'll wait and see. But no, Michelle, I'm a strong supporter of the present flag. Very strong.
But you would like to see the Abbott government go into the next election with a robust reform agenda, say, including tax reform.
Well, like, I'm not going to get into that specificity. I'm just making the general observation that the tolerance span of electorates these days is shorter than it used to be. And that doesn't mean, though, that electorates won't reward policy boldness.
I think there's a bit of advice there. John Howard, thank you very much for talking with us today. Good luck on your book tour, which sounds like a mini election campaign.
It's starting to feel like one, Michelle.
I'm sure you'll do very well. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll be back with another interview soon.